Ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. We are here recording from Amsterdam with the lovely Nina Hein, who took us on a trip through the Rijksmuseum today for the exhibition of Vermeer. And we are here to talk about what we've learned. So you obviously do not need an introduction on the Soleri report. But why don't you just discuss, first of all, what the significance of this particular exhibition is? Why is this one so special?
Well, the exhibition is special because out of about 35, 36 paintings that have survived of Vermeer till our days, the Rijksmuseum has managed to assemble 28 of them in one place. Because they are spread all over museums all over the world, it's almost impossible to do it otherwise. These paintings are fragile and they belong to major collections of major museums, so they usually do not travel. So you can easily call it that this is once in a lifetime exhibition that is not going to be repeated in anybody's lifetime because it's just impossible to put together. So we have to appreciate and be happy that we were able to attend.
And it was quite a wonderful experience, I have to say. For me, it was the first time at the Rijksmuseum. Although I've lived in the Netherlands all my life, I've never been.
And I had to travel 15,000 miles to see it. But yes, we both managed to come here.
But to do it with you was quite the experience, both from an educational standpoint, to hear all the background around all the paintings and to you learn about them was very insightful and is something that that I will cherish as a memory. So thank you for doing that and for taking us all on this wonderful trip.
You're welcome. It was fun. I was very, very, very happy.
So maybe as a starting point, Nina, for the people who are not too familiar with Vermeer, where does this work? Where does it fit into the history of this particular form of art? Where does it fit in? And
well, most people probably know that Vermeer is considered one of the so-called old masters, which it usually means to describe artists who have been creating before 19th century and who are very, very famous, and usually the representatives of art in major European countries such as France or Netherlands or Italy. So roughly the Renaissance, Baroque, and maybe Rococo, till, as I say, end of 18th century. Mm-hmm. So these are so-called old masters, and they include people like, I don't know, Caravaggio and Rembrandt and Michelangelo and Raphael and so on. Vermeer is a special case just because he did not start out as a famous old master until mid-19th century because he was virtually unknown. He was completely forgotten for 200 years, which is something I want to talk about, but we will do it in a minute. But obviously by now, by 21st century, Vermeer is probably one of the most popular artists in the world. Almost everybody is familiar with one or two of his paintings for various reasons. One of them is because at least one painting, which is the girl with the pearl earring, has been popularized by a book, mm-hmm. and by a movie and by countless merchandise. You know, the merch is everywhere, you know, the bags, the postcards, the, I don't know, clothing, mm-hmm. everything. So now he is a little bit like Frida Kahlo. He's much more popular now because of a few iconic images, and people maybe not necessarily pay attention to his art as such. But, you know, anything works, you know. That's what art is for, mm-hmm. after all. So I'm happy with that.
And when we look at Vermeer's work, what are some of the things that are very characteristic about the way he painted? One thing obviously being the light. He was a true master of light, but used it quite differently than other painters of his time, correct?
Technically a little bit more differently than others. there are other masters of light, like Caravaggio, who has kind of invented chiaroscuro to a certain extent, you know, the kind of contrast of light and darkness. Georges de Latour is also a painter of light, if you like. There are 19th century painters like Sorolla, who is also called the master of light for some other reasons. The Impressionists are. So the relationship between an artist and the light is always a very complex one, because that's what the artist does. He takes the color and the light and does something, usually on canvas or on some surface. What is interesting is how Vermeer achieved the effects that he has in his paintings, considering that he is the mid-17th century artist and not a contemporary one, meaning he's someone who created his paintings when the theory of light or the knowledge of how light works was not available. And because of what tricks or what methods he used to create his paintings, they were very unusual, but we can talk about it in a second.
One thing we discovered after visiting the Rijksmuseum today is that the exhibition was fully booked. Everything was sold out. So for all those thousands and thousands of people in the coming couple of weeks who are visiting by, they already have a clear reason to dive into Vermeer's work and something that is attracting them. But for myself, the arts are a thing that I am not very familiar with. So for me, this was an educational experience. Having spent the day with you and learning about something that I know very little about was very inspiring. So maybe a good starting point would also be, as we're talking about those lessons learned, why would anybody spend that time learning about the arts? Where does that fit into a young person's learning plan? As we've spoken about, we're now creating with the Building Wealth curriculum, especially for those young people out there like myself who know nothing about arts. Why does it deserve a place in there? And I've got an answer for myself after today, but maybe you, from your standpoint, would allude to that. Why does it deserve a place in there, and how do you start?
Well, I would have two answers. One is a little bit more serious one, and the other one maybe a more facetious one. So I'll give you both.
Sure.
And you can choose.
By all means.
The more serious one is that there's a reason why I called the website that I write, where I write about art, primarily about art, I called it Food for the Soul, meaning something that feeds something immaterial in us. Mm-hmm. And as I say in the introduction to this website, is that once we have satisfied the basic need, which is drink, or water, and food, and a shelter, meaning the basic needs of a human being, right after that, if you look at the paintings in the caves, is art. And why is it there? Because the humans need, they are kind of hardwired to have something other. We can call it spiritual, you can call it religious, you can call it artistic, but the human being has some other needs than just the basic ones of satisfying the body. Whatever you're going to call it, in intellect or soul or
an expression
spirit.
Of...
Yes.
Yeah.
Both to express, meaning, you know, to paint on the walls of the cave, and to look at it or to experience it somehow, because it relates to our emotions.
And arguably storytelling, right?
Correct. Absolutely. Storytelling or music or art are these things that satisfy something in all humans in some way or form. So in the 21st century, where we have access to museums and education and, you know, so-called culture, if you like, whatever it means, it very often is expressed in liking art. So this is my serious answer, that a lot of people come and attend those exhibitions, or they like art because it satisfies some need in them.
Yes.
The need of something different than the everyday life that we have, right?
Sure.
That revolves around work or family life and whatever needs that we have to satisfy just to exist. So this is the serious answer. The little bit maybe less serious answer is that if you're talking about the preserving or creating wealth. As a person who is much older than you are, I have observed it many times. Once people have achieved a certain standard of wealth, and especially if they came to that standard from fairly humble beginnings, you know, someone who invented something or, you know, whichever way came to wealth, but came to wealth, was not born to it, but created that wealth, right? Yes. And at some point, once he has this wealth, then his lifestyle changes. You know, he has the yacht or he's taking private planes. But one of the components of a life of a very affluent person is being in contact with art, which is because they get to meet famous, you know, celebrities, let's say, famous people, celebrities, or because they travel and then they are invited to a film set or to go to a museum, or they go to very expensive homes which have major art on the walls.
So it's a thing of prestige in that case.
Correct. It comes together with a private plane, the yacht and everything else. And if that person has never been exposed to art, then they feel very uncomfortable, because you can buy yourself a nice suit, but if you absolutely never heard of Picasso and Matisse and Van Gogh and whatever it is, then you feel awkward.
Yes.
So for people who are interested in becoming someone who is going to be successful and affluent 20, 30, 40 years down the line, it's good to learn something about art, because sooner or later in their future lives, they will need it as much as they will need that private plane and that mansion and a trophy wife and beautiful clothes. It comes together as a package. I have spent enough time with this kind of people to know that this is something that is, if you don't have it, you have to acquire it very quickly, and it's difficult. Yeah. So that's my facetious answer, because of course you can live without it and be a boor, but it's difficult to live.
I agree. So if I can just dissect that a little bit. One thing during the Renaissance period, one thing that was required for somebody to be successful, even if you were middle class, you would need to have a proper possession of certain languages. So you would need to be able to speak certain languages fluently, multiple. But then also you would need to play an instrument or have some deeper knowledge about sculpturing, painting, some form of higher art. You had to understand that. So,
cultural package, yes.
Out of interest, why did that get lost? Why is that not a requirement these days?
And I think it got lost. In 19th century, it made maybe for the young lady from a good family, she would have to speak French, and she would have to play an instrument, or she was basically, it was impossible to get her married. She needed to come with that package. And I think these days it's the same thing. If you look at the young people from so-called, whatever you call it, good families, whatever, they usually speak more than one language. They usually have some cultural knowledge of, you know, they know where Taj Mahal is and they have been to the Louvre or whatever. I don't think...
They're probably well-traveled.
It is still a marker of belonging or not belonging to a club, which is why it's important for the kids especially from not very prestigious backgrounds, to give them a chance to go to a museum, to have an art education of some sort, to be exposed to classical music and all these things, because they might come handy, and also because then the gap between the haves and the have-nots is a little bit smaller.
I understand.
So there is obviously something that it is almost like the clothes or the money or whatever. It is a marker of distinction between the people who had access to it or who didn't.
Yes.
So
what you're saying, what I'm hearing, is that the financial equity and the living equity go hand in hand. Is that...
And there's a cultural component that basically makes a distinction. Mm-hmm. Let's say in the, even today, but certainly in the 19th century, you know, the people who were from the so-called upper classes, they knew how to ride horses. And for the men, how to fight, you know, with a, you know, saber or whatever it was, right?
Sure.
It was part of the education.
Yeah. So I'm curious, is that that level of development, the higher possession of an understanding of that culture, is that something that is just correlated to financial development, or is it also bearing a causal effect where, for example, if you listen, it's been proven that if you listen to certain Baroque era music, this can drastically improve your learning speed and comprehension and retention. So is it a symptom of development, or is it something that might also speed up or cause financial development as well by integrating culture into our lives?
Very good question. I mean, it could go either way. I mean, it's a very interesting question, and I don't know if there is an answer to it, but it probably goes hand in hand. Mm. But I'm just saying that the fine art or classical music or whatever should not be something that separates the people. But the problem is that if you have people who, because of the poverty or the situation in which they live in, have never had any access to it, it's very hard to undo that kind of damage. So, you know, in Europe, at least, children get, they do have education in our fine arts or arts in general at school, and they have some musical education because a lot of education is state provided and it's part of the education. In the United States, if you are a kid from an affluent family and you're going to go to a private school, then you're going to have art and music as part of your school program. If you are from the wrong side of the tracks and you go to public education school in poor community,
yes,
there is not going to be any exposure to either art or so-called classical music, but certainly not to art.
Sure.
They never, these kids just grow up and they are never exposed to anything. So they never learn to like it or appreciate or respect or desire it, you know. They are 20, 30 years old and they have never seen any art whatsoever. They are not sensitive to it because they have never been exposed. It's very hard to undo that on a 25-year-old person. It's very easy to undo it. Any 5-year-old is going to like a nice Picasso or a Matisse, the colors, you know, the shapes, the whatever. It's fun. 25-year-old is a little bit too late
hard
for
to,
that.
To rewire again.
Exactly. Yeah. So I am a great proponent of providing access to fine art and classical music or whatever to everybody on the planet, to young people.
So maybe something that dovetails out of this discussion, where it's the intersection between living equity and the financial equity around us. One thing you and I have spoken about today is Vermeer's use of specific pigments that were very expensive and inaccessible at the time, and how that translated into what he created. So maybe why don't we take the conversation into that direction and we talk about how that allows you to open up more possibilities of that expression by having the financial means to be able to.
Well, generally, you know, art is, sorry, that generally art is connected. I mean, everything is about money in the world. The money makes the world go round. But art especially, because not only the access to expensive materials, but the very fact that you're going to sit and devote your time to actually painting and not selling bread in a boutique downstairs, right? So it's a decision. That's why there was a concept of so-called starving artists, because unless you had the support from somewhere, then it was very hard to create art. Vermeer is a perfect example of what happens when he didn't, when you have an artist who didn't have a support. Unlike many others, he didn't have many patrons. He really had only one. He had a large family. Well, maybe that is his fault, but he did have 11 children.
He knew a thing or two about building wealth. Absolutely.
You know, it would be probably better if he had less, but hey, whatever. And he ended up being a bankrupt. It is not entirely his fault, because there was also a very bad economical situation of the place that he lived at the time that he lived. But the truth is that he didn't really have sponsors, and that's what happens when you don't have them. The institutions, like the state support that you have in Europe, or something that in the United States is called the National Endowments for the Arts that was very much threatened during a recent administration. If you don't have that state support, and if you don't have a patron, as it was the habit of artists in many centuries, and you do not come from a wealthy family, then your ability to create art is very much threatened. So, you know, he didn't paint that much, and his legacy was lost for a long time because he was poor and not supported. So it is a lesson that artists, in order to create, they do need to have a support, ideally from some institutions like, for example, state grants.
Yes.
Because it's very hard to just to survive on the air, regardless of what. And these days, of course, you know, a lot of artists digital, for example, and it requires technology, which is also expensive. But also the very fact that you create art instead of, you know, going to the office and work 8 hours a day.
Yeah.
That is the difference. Some people just cannot afford to create art. They have to feed a family. So the lesson is take care of the artist, because something will be lost for the mankind if you do not do that.
And aside from running that family, expressing himself through painting, he was also running several other enterprises, right? So he was a very busy man.
Well, he was just trying to, you know, to survive, to make a living. But it is very hard that you're going to be doing whatever work you're doing during the day, and then you're going to go home when the light is gone, especially in the Netherlands, I'm sorry to say. and then paint something. It's just like...
It's difficult.
It's difficult, you know.
Yes.
Any kind of creation, you know, even if you write poetry or whatever you do, you know, make furniture, you have to have some room to create.
Yeah.
And if you don't have that, if you're all the time in a rat race, it's very, very hard. Yes. So we are lucky that he created anything.
Absolutely. And when I say that he knew a thing or two about building wealth, one thing to get very straight is the fact that building wealth is not just about acquiring financial assets per se. Mm-hmm. It can be a part of that because, like we just discussed, it can provide the means for you to live your free and inspired life, whatever that looks like. And for him, that was obviously expressing himself through painting. So it can provide the financial resources to do that, which then would give him more time to create masterpieces that he would then be able to sell, which would then create this self-sustaining infrastructure. But when Vermeer died, he did leave his family with a fair amount of debt, correct? So how come that was the situation, but also how did this work still got preserved throughout the ages?
Well, it didn't. That's another lesson from Vermeer, that well, there's an irony to it, which I call that no one is a prophet in their own country, so to speak, because Vermeer has indeed died in poverty. There was they had to declare a bankruptcy. His paintings were dispersed because, for example, there's one famous painting called The Art of Painting that is not in this exhibition, that his mother-in-law had to give to a local baker to pay the bills for bread.
Wow.
I mean, she was smart enough to make an agreement that, you know, once she gathers enough money that she's going to buy back that painting, because, you know, she was very attached to this one. So she did have taste, but, you know, the financial situation was very dire. But all I'm saying is that he was completely forgotten. Once his patron died and Vermeer died, the paintings got dispersed. And for about 200 years, there was no Vermeer. And then when he did get discovered again, first there was a German art historian who saw The Art of Painting, that famous painting in Vienna, which was at the time attributed to a different painting. But he started writing that there was this painting and that he thought that it was Vermeer. But the real discovery of Vermeer was done by a French journalist in 1860s. His name was Théophile Thorée-Burger. He discovered those paintings, started writing about the majority of them. He kind of started looking for them in various collections and describing them. He produced a catalogue raisonné in 1866, which is like a list of all the paintings and description where they are and the provenance or whatever.
And they were still in private hands mostly then, correct?
Yeah, they were mostly in private hands, yes, or in collections and misattributed to other Dutch artists. I mean, everybody knew it was kind of Dutch Baroque, but it was not necessarily attributed to him. But he started the process. He started kind of, publicizing. There were not Dutch art historians, collectors, or whatever involved it. It was all done by the foreigners. So all I'm saying is that for me, it was the least appreciated and known in his own country. Where is the lesson? The lesson is there as well for the future generations, that if there is a local artist, promote them and be interested in whatever is locally available to you. Don't let the foreigners from other countries 200 years later discover this is a little bit something that should not have happened to someone else. Vermeer, you went to the exhibition. They are gorgeous paintings. Aren't they wonderful? How can they be
Absolutely.
forgotten for 200 years? Nobody cared at all about those paintings. For me, it's just unbelievable that he was completely forgotten. 200 years. Nobody cared. So this is another lesson for the young people that I would like to impart.
Well, there is something special about how he paints, where he paints about these day-to-day situations that very much resonate with us because we understand them. We can place ourselves into the perspective of the protagonist, if you want to call it, the person at the other side of the painting. And by studying the painting, by looking at it for a couple minutes, you really start to see more and more, and it's like a discovery almost. And then having that context, which I would say for anybody who is new to the arts, having somebody like yourself be a mentor in that situation to talk about the significance of certain aspects of the painting is a crucial thing to have. It's almost like a shortcut, if you will, where you understand certain things and therefore you make you get a better appreciation for those things. When you speak about the way the windows, for example, shed light into the room, and you spoke about the yellow light intersecting the blue of the dress of this lady, and how that light was something that was very extraordinary, which people of his age didn't necessarily understand correctly, which was hinting at the usage of certain kinds of technologies. To know that story behind it, all of a sudden puts a whole different appreciation behind it. So why don't you just talk a little bit about that, about the usage of those tricks or technologies, if you will.
Well, that leads me to a different thing that we talked about, so we just can talk about it again. Another lesson that I call embracing technology makes things better. Because there's a lot of people, for various reasons, who do not, who are against technology for various reasons, or the rapid changes of technology, or use of technology for various reasons, sometimes very deeply philosophical or moral or ethical. I totally understand. But Vermeer is a perfect example how things, why his paintings are better than somebody else's. I mean, he had the talent regardless, of course, but also his paintings are better than somebody else's because of the technology that he used, and you can see it in the paintings. One of the controversies around Vermeer paintings is whether or not he has used some kind of lens or some kind of camera obscura, which is this kind of device where you place it, there are lens inside, and then you kind of project an image that you see onto the paper, and then you can trace it and use it, which was very popular a little bit later than Vermeer, but it was popular certainly in the 1700s, maybe less in the 1600s. But it was known.
Was it accepted to use that?
People just used it. The artists not necessarily shared with everybody else that they have used it, but even, I mean, during Dürer time, even it is a known device. The lens is a different thing. However, There are two schools of thought about Vermeer. We know very little about Vermeer because thanks to his being forgotten for 200 years and nobody caring whether he lives or dies anyway, we have no biography. We don't know where he learned his painting, who from and where and how. We don't know how he lived. We don't know what happened to him before. We know almost nothing about him, or not enough. But anyway.
Isn't that adding to the allure somehow?
As someone who's interested in art, I'm pissed off. I'd like to know more about him, not less. But it is what it is. It's very, you know, some people would embrace the mystery, but I'd like to know. But anyway.
But the mystery opens up interpretation to yourself.
True.
Which can be part of the
allure,
joy.
Yes.
Right, it can be part of the attraction.
Yes. But here, there are two schools of thought. Basically, one group of critics or whatever says, No, he didn't use any technology. He just had a fantastic eye and he just was very precise and painted. There's a second school of thought that says, no, he did use some kind of lens in order to create, for example, a painting that is very, very famous, that is especially famous here, which is The View of Delft, which is a beautiful kind of panorama by the river with two ladies in the front who are talking to each other, but you know the way this is all painted, the panorama is just so precise and so clear and so wonderful. It's much better than any other panorama of Delft of that time. That school of thought is assuming that he was using some lens, because it is also assumed that he was that he knew or was friends with someone called Antoni van Leeuwenhoek, who is the father of microscope, very famous scientist and the producer of lens, or grinder of lens, if you like, in the Netherlands, who lived in Delft, contemporary with Vermeer. We certainly know that he had some connection because he became the executor of his will, of Vermeer's will, so clearly he had some connection. And therefore the assumption is that he used the lens. There's an English painter, the greatest painter alive as far as I'm concerned, called David Hockney, who has written in his book that he has studied it, and according to him, there's certainly been some use of lens. I would rather believe a famous painter who knows how paintings are made, because he makes them, and who is also very interested in technology, iPad, digital photography and everything else, and he knows something about the digital image, for him to say, yes, Vermeer has used lens, then, you know, the art critic in wherever he was, who is just saying, oh, no, this is just because Vermeer was just very precise. I don't buy the precise. There's another thing that you and I talked when we were looking at the exhibition. When the yellow light goes through the prism, you know, the opposite color, the opposite color is blue for the yellow.
Yes.
So when he does the shade and light of the yellowish light that comes through the window and then it goes as a shade onto the wall, it has a bluish tint. So he figured it out. You can figure it out when you look at the photography or through the lens, but it's hard to figure out when you look with the naked eye. The human eye is not very good at seeing the shadow, the lights, and colors because of how we perceive images, which are kind of in the series of things. The brain has fills the gaps in between the images that the human eye sees, which we know that in 20th or 21st century, even in the 19th century, it was known, but not necessarily in the 17th century. So if you don't use the lens, how the hell do you know something that you cannot see with the human eye? With the naked eye, you cannot see it. You see something different with the naked eye. So to me, he used the technology, I'm sorry to say. But I know that there are schools of thought. But for me, this is a perfect example that technology makes things better if you use them smartly and you use them as an artist.
And with integrity.
Correct.
Because embracing technology could be dangerous in certain situations, but in this case, it clearly contributed to the end result.
But he was an artist. He wasn't waging a war, so yeah.
There you go.
There you go.
And obviously, you also spoke about, you used the analogy of the kitchen and the chef, where you said, regardless of what is happening in the kitchen, if the end result is pristine, is brilliant, then fantastic.
Absolutely.
I don't care whether they use certain amounts of stew in their cutlery or certain methods to cook the food. If the end result is fantastic, then
exactly.
I'll settle for that. And I'm happy about that. So embracing technology can definitely add to the result.
Correct.
You also mentioned today Goethe and his theory of life. Where does that fit in with?
Oh, it's just that, you know, Goethe was slightly different because we're talking 19th century.
Yes.
Early, but still 19th century. So obviously it was not known, that theory of color was not known in the 17th century. So Vermeer obviously has worked out certain things for himself, part of his tricks of secrets of an artist, which you can see on the canvas. We don't know any documentation for it, but you know, you see what you see. And that's why his paintings are so fantastically different from anybody else's. I mean, all of them, Michelangelo and Raphael and Rembrandt, they all had their own tricks that they used that they did not necessarily share with anybody else. But a very, very good artist always works out certain things for themselves. They don't necessarily share, but they work it out.
This is their part of their authenticity, perhaps, where it's
correct.
A chef's secret, which makes them unique.
Yeah, I mean, the chef does not share all the cooking tricks either, right?
No.
So that's what it is. It's a very good analogy that you made, yes.
So today, it's fair to say that Vermeer has really skyrocketed his reputation from the cities of the city of Delft all the way to the global theater of arts. And he is celebrated across the world. People are flying in from everywhere to see this exhibition.
500,000 people.
And people are writing about it. So journalists are covering it these days with other artists that are currently creating their works. How do we make sure that it's not lost for two centuries again? How do we make sure that it's captured now and celebrated, and it doesn't end up in private hands in some corridor in some castle somewhere remotely?
Well, things are a little bit different just because the amount of artists active in the 21st century all over the world is so much bigger than the number of artists that were active then. If we're just talking about so-called Western culture, not to mention the rest of the world. So the competition is much harder. But also there's a proof of time in a way, meaning I go a lot to museums, as you can imagine. And when I look at contemporary or modern art, which I love, but if I go to a museum, sometimes I just walk through those, you know, one room after the other of modern art, and I'm just looking at it and thinking, half of the stuff that I'm looking at the end of the century, or even within 50 years, will be completely gone, meaning no one will care. It will not be popular. It will not be famous. A lot of it's just, you know, a gimmick or whatever, and it's just not going to last.
It's just a temporary trend.
Absolutely. So there is that you sometimes need interpreters, you know, art critics or collectors or whatever, other artists, to be able to cut through this noise of so many works of art and so much hype that is not necessarily translating to the lasting art. Sometimes you just walk into a room and you see something that just strikes you, and you can see that in 100 years, it still will be great art. Something is great art. Sometimes some things are just like, it's there. It's a wonderful art. You know, Francis Bacon was a perfect example of that. This English painter of, let's say, 1950s. His art is very brutal, but, you know, you just look at any painting, even if you know nothing about art, and you can see that this is something that is a major thing. But a lot of art, especially the so-called, not art in the old-fashioned sense of, you know, canvas and paint, which is less and less popular, but, you know, kind of, you know, video installation, some kind of, you know, sculpture that uses everyday objects or whatever. And you just look at it, it's like, and it's in the eye of the beholder, meaning
of course.
Maybe it's beautiful, maybe it isn't.
So like, that's a large subjective component there that decides the value of it. But with the...
But that's why collectors love it, because it's a gamble. It's like going to a casino. You know, you're going to invest, you know, a couple of million dollars on a piece of art. Maybe it's going to be art in 20 years and you just won a lotto and it's going to be a great investment. Well, it's like stock market, right?
Mm.
You invested in stock, but hell, do you know if the stock is gonna perform or is it gonna tank?
True. Well, there can be
So
huge speculative value, of course, in arts and these kind of
there is a
markets, but
speculative value
yes.
in everything. You know, you have no idea. I mean, yes, sure, if you bought yourself a Picasso, then the chances are that, you know, you invested well if you managed to buy it. You can't buy a Vermeer anyway. But with modern art, you know, good luck to you. You know, you could be investing in something that is gonna be valuable in 50 years, or maybe not.
Of course. What about the say the works of not only Vermeer, Rembrandt, maybe going further back, when we think about Da Vinci or Michelangelo, there seems to be a universal beauty in there that is not left to subjective interpretation, which sometimes they speak about the golden ratio, for example, in Da Vinci's work. Is that something that is just always there and it's for us as a human being to resonate with, regardless of what we think about it subjectively? Is that something that is not necessarily left to our biases or conditioning? We spoke about the impoverished people, for example, not growing up with an appreciation of certain kinds of music, classical music in particular. Is this something that is just intrinsically there in us as a human species, something universal almost?
I think yes, but a lot of people will disagree with you for various reasons, especially political and social and whatever. I mean, there is something like you talk about the golden division, proportional golden proportions or Fibonacci sequence or whatever that we know technically exists, mathematically exists, and the human beings being part of nature kind of react to it very favorably because it's something that is perceived by us as well proportioned and we like it just because this is part of nature. So there is that. I think that most people would react positively to looking at the beautiful, it's like looking at a beautiful human face, you know. So when you look at the Botticelli and the face of that woman, to us, to humans, is beautiful. Maybe it's not beautiful to a gorilla because they have a different standard of looking at things, but for the humans, a very regular, beautiful face of a human being is something that most people react positively because they've done tests with newborn babies or whatever, and they look at the well-proportioned face longer than the one that is slightly off kilter. So I believe that there is something like a natural beauty, and as a person who loves art, for me, that goes much further than that. You know, for me, beautiful art is beautiful art. And but there is obviously something in the eye of the beholder. Some people, you know, think that,
Of course.
I don't know, Basquiat or something modern like Andy Warhol, whatever, is beautiful. And some people think, oh, no, this is, you know, this is something that they really do not react well. I think that old, so-called old masters, you know, from Raphael, Botticelli, you know, Italian Renaissance through like Vermeer, whatever, stays in that canon of things that most people will agree this is fairly beautiful. They're not gonna say, oh, this sucks, I don't like it. Most people will say, yes. If you actually react to art, and some people don't react to art at all, but this is the same kind of people who might not react to any kind of music,
Sure.
right? And they would just say, well, I don't like music, period. So it varies, but it's fascinating, you know, what in every century or so, the canon of beauty is different, right?
Yes. Yeah.
So it changes.
So Vermeer's work clearly fits into the Baroque era, if I'm not mistaken, but then is slightly different in his use of his facial expressions, for example, or the usage of light.
Well, you and I, when we were looking at paintings, you noticed yourself that in some paintings that he painted, especially later on, Vermeer paintings have a feature, usually it's a woman, of course, who turns around and looks at you directly. This was not something that was done that often, certainly not in portraiture in the period that we are talking about. Yes, there would be a frontal face when you did a portrait, you know, like a, you know, photo that someone needs to have on the wall, right? But generally, if you did a scene, the people painted in that scene would not be looking at the viewer directly. It is done, but not often. He would do it on purpose because he wanted the interaction between you, the viewer, and the person to tell a certain story or to allow you a certain interpretation of what he's trying to say. In that, he's much more modern than his contemporaries, like Rubens, for example, whatever. Yeah,
it's quite a bold thing to do, just to stick your head outside of the
It's almost like in the theater, you break the fourth wall that the actor is talking directly to the audience. That's called breaking the fourth wall. Some plays are designed that way, that, you know, the people interact and then they turn to the audience and saying, well, what do you think of this character? It's called breaking the fourth wall. And I think he does that a little bit in his paintings, which is an extremely modern thing. I think the one of the reasons that we love Vermeer so much, that, you know, that you have a 500,000 people who flew to Amsterdam to see it,
remarkable,
is because he feels very, very modern in the way he paints, meaning very, you know, using the light and the precision and the photographic kind of approach, and also because the stories that he shows allow us an interpretation, and because they interact with us. There's a lot of reasons why he feels so much modern than, especially that in the 19th century, there was a period of so-called realism and then naturalism, which was a movement in art. And it feels less modern, even if though it was very precise, than Vermeer does. So there's something in him that is not in other painters. I love him, and a lot of people do, but as I say, this is because he's unusual. In art, the same way as in real life, using common sense is very useful. And I'll tell you a little art story to illustrate that.
Please.
That is a Vermeer story. Vermeer has not painted many religious paintings. You know, there's about a couple of them, really. Suddenly, in the early 20th century, there was suddenly a slew of so-called discovered paintings, usually of the religious theme, which was very satisfying to the art critics because it kind of felt like there was a hole in the body of work of Vermeer because he was Catholic, and this was the time that everybody was painting religious paintings, and there aren't really many in his body of work. So everybody got very excited because by 1920s, for example, 1930s of the 20th century, everybody wanted to have a Vermeer. So if there is something that like that that shows up on the market, you know, more power to everybody. So they became very popular. People started buying them. And then the Second World War came in, and there was a guy called Hermann Göring who wanted to have a Vermeer painting, and he bought himself one in 1940s. For the equivalent of more or less today's money, $6.5 million, which for the 1940s was a lot of money. Then after the war, the person who sold it to him, whose name was Han van Meegeren, was accused of collaborating with the Nazis and put on the trial in 1946. Which at the time would mean that he could lose his life. So in order to prove that he did not sell a Vermeer to Hermann Göring, but that he falsified it, he actually had to paint in front of the jury another painting from that series to prove that he was a forger. So then he was tried as a forger, of course, but at least he didn't lose his life. Which is how the world has discovered that dozens of paintings, which were in museums and collections all over the world, were actually fakes.
Wow.
There was, you know, Christ at the Supper of Emmaus. There was, you know, Christ in the House of Martha and Mary. You know, there's very, very famous paintings in collections of major museums, which all turned out to be fakes. But if you look at the reproductions of those paintings, you know, because they are very well known, not only they were well documented, but they are now a collection. They are collected as, you know, under the real name of the forger, but they are still being collected. If you look at those paintings with the 21st century eye, like you and I would be looking at it, and you use your common sense and you just look at it, and it's just like, well, yes, it's nicely painted, it looks nice, but like hell, it is a Vermeer. Mm-hmm. I mean, you just look at it and it just doesn't feel like right. Use your common sense.
Yes.
But the urge of the collectors to own a Vermeer, the hunger to own a real Vermeer, and
blind.
The art critics to make a discovery of the new forgotten, you know, painting that no one has had, it was so strong that they would just disregard the common sense. But common sense is very good in art. Sometimes you look and it's obviously something is off there. In that case, you know, the colors were off, first of all, they were very muddy. Secondly, the faces were, you know, it was a Vermeer pose, but it just didn't feel right. Mm-hmm. It just felt something is off. And the very fact that he was able to function so well and sell for millions of dollars, you know, the paintings that were really obviously fake. And besides, you know, also the financial common sense. How come suddenly in 1920s, 1930s, you find, you know, 25 new Vermeers, you know, within the space of 10 years? I mean, really, seriously. You didn't find anything for 300 years, and suddenly there's so many of them, and they were just like, you know, miraculously appeared on the market. As a businessman, you should just look at it and saying, well, something is really off, and there's some forgery going on. But people would just disregard it. So it is an interesting lesson in business and in common sense and in the art market, which these days is very interesting because it's a very complicated and it's a very rapacious and aggressive market. So this is one lesson.
Well, there is an inherent scarcity because Vermeer passed away and we will never have another authentic Vermeer.
We never know. Maybe we'll find something.
Maybe somebody will be discovered. Yes.
But there's a Caravaggio that was found not a long time ago. So yeah, maybe.
Who knows? But his knowledge was never passed on to any. He didn't teach any pupils at the time, did he?
Yeah, interestingly enough, he didn't seem to have pupils and he didn't. We don't know who was his teacher. So he's just in the void. He just appeared, painted and disappeared. You know.
What about his 10 children?
None of them seem to have been following him, unfortunately. 11. Well, the daughters would never do it because, you know, it was not the time. But no, sadly no. Or at least we don't know. These were very difficult politically. They were very, very difficult times. So it was very hard to just survive, much less to be an artist. He's just an outlier, one-off.
Well, I feel very fortunate having had the opportunity to see all of his work today in real life. And unfortunately, everything is sold out. So the exhibition, this one was truly unique. But his works will be scattered again to their respective homes. Mm-hmm. So people can definitely go and visit them there. Mm-hmm. What will you say or what should people do at this point? What's the next action item for them on their list to learn more about either Vermeer or other contemporaries of his age? Or are there any other names that you would highly suggest people that are interested in this in this way of painting,
well,
to go and study?
It is not my place to be telling people what art they should like or should not. Art, luckily, is something that there's no really good art and bad art in a sense that, you know, it is whatever makes you happy to look at. You know, people have different tastes and different preferences. But what I would say as a lesson, especially to the younger generation, is that if you are even remotely interested in art, go and look at the art while you still can, because there are no guarantees in life that this art will be there when you go there next time. And I can give you a perfect example of Johannes Vermeer, because there is a beautiful, famous painting called The Concert, which is the three people, one woman playing the virginal. There is a guy who is playing some kind of lute, and then there is another person who is singing. The three people, beautiful, beautiful painting. It was purchased by Isabella Stewart Garden at the end of the 19th century for her collection when she was setting up her museum in Boston. In 1990, during the St. Patrick's Day in Boston, there were two fake policemen who went to the museum pretending to be the policemen once they were let in by the two guards, out of which one was actually a music student, so he was as much a guard as I was, you know, meaning not qualified. They went in, spent a couple of hours, stole 13 paintings, including Rembrandt's The Christ in the Sea of Galilee, which is the only seascape that Rembrandt has ever painted, and the concert by Vermeer, that was 1990. The paintings were never found. We do not have them. The future generations, anybody who was born after 1990 is screwed. There is no way to see the painting. I'm sorry. We don't know where the paintings are. They may be destroyed. They were probably at some point taken over by the Irish or Italian mafia, whatever. That was a period that was very common. Maybe the paintings still exist. Maybe it was destroyed. All I'm saying is that the lesson is that if you like art, go and see that art, because there are no guarantees that this art is going to be there next time you go there. So for the future generations, you know, if you have seen it, that's fine, but it might not last. Art is very fragile, and the more important and the more precious the art, the bigger chance it is that it might get destroyed. You know, there is a, you know, there are wars.
Or stolen.
There are thefts. There are, you know, there are various natural disasters. There are reasons why things sometimes just disappeared. I, you know, on my website, I wrote the whole series about, you know, the art that was either destroyed or lost or recovered or whatever. But things happen to art, and art is unique. You know, if something exists, there is no second of the same.
Exactly.
So the lesson is go and see it.
Take your chance now that you can.
Exactly.
Well, it was an absolute privilege. It was an absolute privilege having had the opportunity to go there with you.
It was fun, no?
And for everybody who would like to go there with Nina, we will have an audio recording of Nina talking us through all the 28 different works of Vermeer. So we will also be uploading this, and you can go on a virtual tour with Nina through the Rijksmuseum. Nina Hines, thank you very much.
Thank you.
It was an absolute privilege. Thank you.
Thank you.